This is podcast number 195 for the Well-Educated Mother's Heart. Hi, I'm Marlene Peterson, and today I want to talk about the pageant of Chinese history. I hope to get back to highlighting more books through these podcasts. Today, I have a book I've wanted to recommend for a long time but didn't know how to get it to you. There's only a few copies to buy, and they're really expensive. The book was written in 1933, so it doesn't fall in public domain, so I can't republish it. But the good news is it is now available as a digital read in Internet Archive. The book is called The Pageant of Chinese History by Elizabeth Seeger and was actually the Newbery Award winner the year it came out. She was a schoolteacher and wrote this book about Chinese history because she couldn't find anything out there for young people. Let me share what she said in her intro. She wrote, "At that time, many general histories were being published, stories of the world and of man and so forth. Considering their titles, I looked hopefully at these. But alas, in books of 50 or 60 chapters, one or two were devoted to the farther countries of Asia. Books for adult reads were little or no better. General histories of civilization, art, philosophy, literature, and so forth are still being written, with no mention of the unsurpassed achievements of the East. What a strange disproportion is this! After all, it is close to 700 years since the Polos made their way to Cambaluc, and more than 400 since Vasco da Gama sailed to Calicut. How long are we going to look at every aspect of human life with only one eye? Besides the practical need of knowing about these great nations that are still so strange to most of us, we can ill afford to lose the intrinsic and beauty of their histories. Surely there is no history more thrilling and delightful than that of China. All the thousands of years of the nation's growth are a mine of interest and enjoyment, which is only partially open to us." This book is a wonderful introduction to the study of the country. If you were to later add in Wild Swans, which is the story of three generations of women in modern China, told through the eyes of a woman who grew up in China during Mao's Cultural Revolution, you would have a great foundation to build upon to begin to understand this nation that headlines so much of our news today. I love her introduction to the study because she expressed something I've seen myself and have tried to express to you, the idea of each nation being like a family member who, after being apart for a long time, is bringing their story to the family reunion, which is the work of our age. It will make more sense when I read it to you in just a minute. I just love connections. I'm reading When the Mountain Meets the Moon to my grandchildren, ages 4, 6, and 8, and it talks about the jade dragon, which you will see mentioned in this selection I'm about to read. We're loving the book, which also happens to be a story about the power of stories. And then the first story in my world storybook is Fu He. And here he is again in the first chapter of the Pageant of Chinese History. So let me share part of chapter one to give you a flavor for the book. It really is a wonderful addition to your study of China. And by the way, she had children from the 4th to 8th grades in mind. Chapter 1, Mythical Times. We are living at a time when all the nations of the world are being brought together and, for the first time, are beginning to know each other well. Steamships and airplanes, railways and radio are bringing the very ends of the earth together, and we realize that our world is not so tremendously big as it seemed to be a little while ago. We meet people of other countries at every turn and find, to our surprise, that they are not so very different from ourselves. The nations are like a big family of brothers who separated a long time ago, going to different parts of the earth, where they found different places and climates and conditions to live and to work in. Each had his own adventures, and each has treasures to bring to the others when they meet together. Of course, they have met often enough in the course of history, sometimes by chance and sometimes on purpose, trading with one another or fighting or learning from one another. But now it seems that we're going to know one another better than that and, sooner or later, live and work together as a family should. China is an older brother who was separated for a long, long time from the rest of the family and who has rich treasures of knowledge and of art and of wisdom to bring to us. We are only now beginning to know China, even a little, yet it is one of the oldest nations on our earth. Its history began thousands of years ago, and although the other older nations, such as Egypt or Persia or Babylonia, either fell to pieces or were conquered by younger and stronger ones, China has lived through wars and conquests and is still one of the largest and most important countries in the world. When the pyramids were being built in the Valley of the Nile, China, too, was building up her early kingdom along the Huang Ho. And when Babylonian wise men were studying the stars and measuring the sky, the Chinese were making a calendar and foretelling the eclipses. When the Greeks were setting up their free and vigorous little states in the hilly peninsula that was their home, China had been for over 1,000 years a feudal kingdom. There was a wonderful time about 500 or 600 years before Christ, when all over the world wise and holy men taught their people how to live. Buddha lived in India, Zoroaster in Persia, Socrates in Athens, and at the same time in China, Lao Tzu and Confucius were living and teaching. When Rome conquered the shores of the Mediterranean Sea and pushed up into the wilderness of Europe, conquering too the barbarians of France and Spain and Britain, the Han Dynasty in China was ruling wisely and well over a vast empire. They heard of each other vaguely, those two great empires, and wealthy Romans wore Chinese silk, which came to them after long and dangerous journeys over deserts and mountain passes and wilderness, passing from one trader to another until it was finally loaded on the Roman galleys in Syria or Alexandria. Both empires were attacked by hordes of barbarians. Rome was destroyed, but China was not. During the Dark Ages of confusion in Europe, China was growing steadily, living richly, and making beautiful works of art, for there never were finer artists or finer craftsmen than the Chinese. They made such lovely things that when finally the hardy European explorers, Marco Polo and others, actually reached China, it seemed to them a fairyland. The cities and palaces were so magnificent, the government so peaceful and orderly, the art so exquisite, the riches so amazing that no one in Europe could believe that such a wonderful place could exist. They thought Marco Polo a great liar, but they did not forget the stories he told about it. Explorers and discoverers braved the dangers of the journey around Africa and across unknown oceans in order to find it. It was because of China that Columbus sailed across the Atlantic Ocean on that daring voyage that ended when he found the two continents of America lying across his path. From the time when the greedy traders of Europe reached them, the Chinese were never left in peace again, though that was all that they desired. They disliked and scorned all foreigners and were perfectly content with what they had in their own rich land. They were forced to know the rest of the world, however, and now they stand side by side with us and are our neighbors. Since their history has marched along before ours and besides ours for so long and is now mingled with our own, is it not worth knowing? Let us go back and hear the whole of their story from the beginning. A long, long time ago, thousands of years before Christ, a tribe of men lived on the banks of the Wei River and along the elbow of the Huang Ho, where it turns at right angles and runs eastward to the sea. We do not know where these men came from. Perhaps they came in from Central Asia, seeking more fertile and kindly country than they could find at that time in the middle of the continent. Perhaps they had always lived right there. At all events, they were a strong and active band of men, resolved to make a home for themselves on the luxuriant land that seemed to belong to them. And what a beautiful land it was! Fertile prairies, watered by great rivers, stretched before them. Mountains rose to the south and west, and wooded hills surrounded them and sheltered them. Many wild animals and birds shared their home with them, and trees and flowers made it beautiful. But in the hills and the marshes, wild tribes of strange men hid from them and watched them, or attacked and stole from them. The land had to be worked for and fought for, and this tribe of men, who called themselves the Black-Haired People, were good fighters and even better workmen. They were strong and straight of body, with yellowish skins and black eyes and hair, a cheerful people, always ready to laugh and to sing. They were wanderers, hunting for their food, living in shelters made of boughs or in caves hollowed out of the soft yellow soil that covers that part of China. Most nations, as they look back on their early history, tell stories about certain godlike men who lived among them and taught them how to live. The Egyptians said that Osiris, their divine king, and his queen, Isis, taught them how to raise grain, how to marry and to live in homes, how to govern themselves and to live in peace. The Chinese, too, say that there were great men in their early days who led them and civilized them. These men lived so long ago that their lives are myths, and no one can tell how true their stories are. It must have taken hundreds of years to do the things that they were supposed to do, and many men must have thought and labored to bring these things about. But as people look back through the dimness of the past, they remember only the greatest men and give them the things that should also be given to many others. Fu He was the first of the leaders of the Black-Haired People. He showed them how to live in families and in groups, and he taught them to tame and to herd sheep and to fish in the rivers. He taught them to build houses of mud and wood, to marry and to make homes, to bring up their children and to stay together in groups that could help each other and work together. After this, they called themselves the 100 Families. 100 meant a great many, not just 100. They say that even then, so long ago, Fu He made a sort of picture writing that could be understood, and that the people made music with pipes and drums and a stringed instrument. When Fu He taught them to fish, he also made a song for the fishermen to sing. Other animals besides sheep were tamed. Pigs and dogs and horses became useful companions, and wild fowl, cocks and hens, ducks and geese, were caught in the lakes and forest and kept around the houses for food and for their eggs. These people felt very close to the earth. They looked with awe at the mountains that seemed to rule over the land and to protect it, and at the broad, strong river that was always flowing so mysteriously past their homes. Sometimes in early summer, when the first rains came, the river rose and flooded over their land, and they had to run for their lives to the wooded hills and build shelters and live there until the water went down again. What had happened? Was the river dragon angry with them? For they believed that dragons lived in every river, and that there were sky dragons, too, who brought the summer rains. Everything around them seemed to have life, even the stones. The mountains and the rivers were good and powerful, but some of the spirits of earth and sky seemed to be wicked and mischievous, and these made them afraid. Of course they wondered how the world was made, and, like many nations, turned their wonderings into a story. When a child asked its mother, "What are the stars? Who made the sun?" the mother answered, "Pan Ku made it all. He was a mighty being who lived long, long ago, when earth and sky and water were all mixed up together, and there was no sun and no moon. Pan Ku stood in the midst of it all with a chisel and a mallet, and he shaped the heavens and hewed out the earth. As he worked, he grew until he was so tall that he could lift up the heavens into their place and spread out the earth. He held the sun in one hand and the moon in the other. When it was all in order, Pan Ku died, but his death made his work perfect. His head became the mountains, his breath the winds and clouds, his voice the thunder, his blood the rivers, his flesh the soil, his bones became the rocks, and the marrow of his bones the metals and the precious stones that lie within the rocks." Fu He thought a great deal about all this, and so did other men who were like him. The story of Pangku did not satisfy them. They wanted to know what meaning and what purpose there was in all that they saw, and how men ought to live. They wanted some plan for the people to live by, for just as you make a plan of a house before you build it, so a great civilization is usually built up according to a plan or a vision, and we call that sort of plan of life a religion. These men were beginning to think out the religion of the black-haired people, and we shall hear more about it later. Though they believed in dragons and in spirits of nature, they felt that there was a great power above all other powers, just as the sky is above all the things on earth. They called this power Tian, which means heaven, or Shang Ti, which means Supreme Lord. We call it God. Fu He went up on top of a high mountain in the east and worshipped God. Well, that gives you a little introduction. It's a great little book. Check it out in Internet Archive, and bye-bye. I'll see you next time.